Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We meet in memorial for our colleague Thomas Fairchild, who passed away earlier this year after almost 41 years of service to the federal judiciary, including service as Chief Judge of this court. Judge Fairchild also served as a Justice of the Supreme Court of Wisconsin, as a United States Attorney, as a member for several decades of the Council of the American Law Institute, and many other positions. He had a distinguished career, and he has been a friend to us all. We will hear remarks today from five of his friends and colleagues, starting with Circuit Judge Richard Cudahy. We will also hear from Circuit Judge Rena Radji of the Second Circuit, from District Judge Joan Humphrey Lefko, from Magistrate Judge Michael T. Mason, and from William Connolly. And before we begin with the remarks from Judge Cudahy, I would also like to note that we are honored today by the presence of Gary Swigert, the wife of his longtime colleague, Luther Swigert. Welcome, Gary.
Tom Fairchild was the chief when I arrived here in 1979. He was, of course, a widely admired Wisconsin public figure, famous in both political and judicial circles. I knew him best as a judicial colleague, always to be relied on for great wisdom and balance and fairness. But I knew him first as a political figure, where he projected many of the same qualities that marked his eminence as a judge. The first contact that I ever had with him was in making a small, very small financial contribution to one of his political campaigns. I couldn't tell you which one. I made the contribution simply because at the time, which was near the beginning of his lifetime of accomplishment, I thought he was someone I would like and admire. I was somewhere in the military service at the time, and mine was a long-distance admiration. The contribution provided a good start for our relationship because somehow a candidate never seems to forget those who came to his support early in the game, especially if they haven't been asked. That's probably the most important part. I, of course, never dreamed that I would someday be a colleague of Tom serving under his leadership. He was an extraordinary leader. The first day I was to take my place on an assigned panel of the court to hear argument, Tom suddenly appeared at the door of my chambers, ready to escort me to the robing room, which he then proceeded to do. This is certainly an unusual gesture for a chief judge. Ever since then, I have successfully made my way to the robing room in a variety of courts all by myself. But perhaps I wouldn't have if Tom hadn't figuratively led me by the hand the first time. Tom's leadership was also in strong evidence in more conventional ways. When he was chief, he and his charming wife, Eleanor, were always forthcoming in holding social events, formal and informal, which were particularly heartwarming for us then younger members of the court. I was also impressed by what a superb lawyer he was. I don't think anyone could have doubted that he had the heart of a great jurist. But the technical prowess that he brought to the task was at least equally impressive. For anyone who doubts this, I would refer you to United States versus Schmuck. I'll never forget the name of the case. Which involved the somewhat obscure question whether odometer tampering or alteration in the sale of a used car is a lesser included offense of mail fraud and therefore requires a jury instruction on the possibility of finding a defendant guilty of the lesser odometer offense. Originally, Judge Fairchild had descended from a panel opinion written by Judge Swigert, who might have been seen, I think, as his normal ally, granting a new trial to a defendant to whom such an and instruction had been refused. Thereupon, a majority of the court voted to rehear the case in bank. And in that process, Judge Fairchild emerged in the majority and wrote an intricate opinion rife with footnotes exploring with subtlety the numerous musty precedents. As if a drubbing by one's colleagues was not enough, the case went on its way to the Supreme Court, which was happy to affirm Judge Fairchild and to leave me a dissenter in the dust. Although this happened more than 20 years ago, I remember it quite vividly as a demonstration of Tom's professional expertise. I recall with equal clarity his pithy comments in conference in recommending outcomes for the numerous cases that came before us for evaluation. During his time on the court, Tom was also a leading author of patent law opinions, which are not infrequently an indicator of juridical skill, as demonstrated by the likes of Learned Hand, who wrote a lot of them, and John Minor Wisdom, who always impressed me with his when he was sitting with us up here. In the case of Saunders versus Airflow Company, Judge Fairchild addressed a windshield or deflector upon the cab of a semi-trailer designed to improve the flow of air past the cab and the following trailer. The district court had found that the principle of and use of a windshield or baffle as a protection against airflow pressure and the creation of low-pressure eddies behind a wind baffle had been known and illustrated by no less a creative genius than Leonardo da Vinci, if you can believe that. But the district court found that the airflow accused device was forwardly concave in a horizontal plane. Judge Fairchild, on the other hand, found that the airflow shield to be forwardly convex in a horizontal plane. And of such antitheses as these, I think the law of patents is composed, in particular, and I think in general as well. Although Judge Fairchild is perhaps more renowned for his insight into the social context of the Chicago Seven, his mastery of the pivotal points of the law of patents also established his claim to an extraordinary skillfulness as a judge. The likes of Tom Fairchild are not likely to be seen again on this court anytime soon. To have had the opportunity of serving with him was both a wonderful pleasure and a unique educational experience. He left his mark, as few others have done or are likely to do in the future, as we can foresee it.
Thank you, Dick. I want to add that there is no reason to believe that Congress took patent cases away from this court in 1982 in response to anything Tom Fairchild did. Yes.
Or Luther Schweiger.
Indeed. George Ratner.
Thank you, Chief Judge Easterbrook. May it please the court. I am greatly honored to participate in this ceremony. You only had to know Thomas Fairchild for a short time to realize that he was a great storyteller with an amazing memory for detail. Whether he was describing one of his political battles in Wisconsin or the trial evidence in an appeal he was working on, Judge Fairchild always had a complete and easy command of the facts. But I wonder how many people outside the judge's chambers knew that he actually worked on his memory. One of the exercises he used to keep it sharp was to recall on any given day where he had been and what he had been doing 10 or 20 or 30 years earlier. Well, I'm not going to pretend that my memory equals Judge Fairchild's, but as it happens, I do know where I was 30 years ago today. I was in this building in the ninth month of my clerkship with then Chief Judge Thomas Fairchild. Chicago was just emerging from what had been a terribly hard winter during which GSA had struggled, as you might imagine, unsuccessfully, to heat 219 South Dearborn, but no matter. Inside Judge Fairchild's chambers, the atmosphere, if not the temperature, was always sunny and warm. It was in that remarkably nurturing climate that Judge Fairchild taught me and so many other young clerks valuable lessons about the pursuit of legal excellence and invaluable lessons about basic human decency. You know, in a few months, I will likely repeat this Fairchild memory exercise. Only then I'll get to recall a July day, 20 years ago, when Judge Fairchild traveled from Chicago to New York to swear me in as a federal judge. It meant a great deal to me that I repeat the words of the judicial oath right after the man whose career was and remains my model. I suppose I thought that if I said the words of the oath very quickly right after Judge Fairchild, somehow I might be able to mimic not only his inflection, but his wisdom, diligence, and humanity. For years, those of us who had been part of the judge's chambers family knew we could readily tap into those qualities just by stopping by or calling to talk with the judge. Whatever difficulties we were experiencing, personal or professional, the judge's insights could always put things in perspective. It is hard to accept that from now on we will have to rely on memory exercises for that help. Still, today my memories are vivid, and they allow me to celebrate one of the court's great judges and one of the finest gentlemen I have ever known. When you read a Fairchild opinion, and let me assure you, you are reading a Fairchild opinion, not one written by a law clerk, the most striking feature is clarity. The issue in dispute is plainly identified, the relevant facts are crisply outlined, and the legal analysis is just that, a thoughtful discussion of the relevant law and of the reasons why its application yields a particular result. What you will not find in a Fairchild opinion is dicta, hyperbole, or clever shots aimed at lawyers, parties, or the circumstances that bring them into the court. The judge's aversion to dicta might surprise some who knew his strong social ideals. He was, after all, a liberal Democrat with a capital D. But he was, first and foremost, a judge's judge, who thought his task was to decide the issues presented in a given case, nothing more or less. In my year with the judge, I recall one case in which I naively urged him to push the law a bit more than the case demanded. My arguments met that benign and patient smile to no avail. The case did not require the judge to reach that far, and for him, that was the end of the matter. So, although my judicial commissions are signed by Ronald Reagan and George Bush, it was a Wisconsin liberal who taught me my first lesson in judicial restraint. The judge's resistance to hyperbole in his opinions derived directly from his profound respect for both the record and the English language. Every one of Judge Fairchild's clerks can picture him seated at a table in chambers with volume after volume of the record before him. He would read every page. He thought he owed it to the parties. For the judge, appellate cases were about more than abstract legal principles. They were about flesh and blood human beings. And the judge never lost sight of the real-life consequences his decisions would have for scores of people. What was remarkable about the judge's review of a record was his ability, sympathetically and often simultaneously, to entertain the viewpoints of the various parties. The judge was always ready to consider that justice might lie in a view other than the one that he instinctively brought to a case. Only after the judge was satisfied that he totally understood the record would he apply the law to the party's dispute, a task that for him required, above all, clear expression. Fairchild opinions read easily. When you finish, the result can seem obvious, even inevitable. There were certain chambers' rules to achieve that effect. No string cites. Indeed, no case cites without case discussion. No expressions of judicial belief. For the judge, the law required a judge to think, not to engage in leaps of faith. And no split infinitives. As we all learned, his high school English teacher wouldn't allow them. And so with these and other rules, we acquired an enduring memory of a man seated quietly at his desk, writing with blue ink on white-lined paper, often with crumpled balls of paper on the floor, the remnants of efforts that did not quite satisfy the judge's high standards for clarity. It was by example that he taught us that a great deal of hard work is necessary to create what seems like a straightforward decision. If the judge would not tolerate split infinitives, he was even more insistent on banishing from his opinions clever observations at the expense of the parties or their circumstances. It's not that the judge was naive about human folly. His background was politics. He was an expert on the subject. It's just that he was the most courteous of men. For the judge, it was inconceivable that someone in his position would try to demonstrate his own cleverness at the expense of another person. In this way, and so many others, Judge Fairchild taught his clerks not only how to be good lawyers, but how to be good people. But I've omitted one of the best things about clerking for Judge Fairchild. It was fun. It's been said that if you find something to do that you love, you'll never work a day in your life. That describes the judge. He loved what he did, and he had a good time doing it. And in the process, he made sure everybody else had a good time, too. I remember frequent spirited discussions about the law. I recall the judge working hard to achieve just the right expression in an opinion. But I don't remember him agonizing over cases. More to the point, I don't remember him making anybody else's time in chambers seem like agony while the work was done. Instead, I remember lots of laughter and countless acts of kindness, usually associated with lunch at the university club or evenings at Berghoff's. I remember generous praise for hard work, and perhaps most important, I remember a sense conveyed silently but effectively to each clerk, to each person in this court, that somehow the judge saw more in us than we had seen in ourselves. Perhaps that is the most valuable memory the judge leaves us with, the one that demands that we never let him down. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Radji. Judge Lefkoe.
Colleagues of Judge Fairchild, It's really my honor and great pleasure to commemorate the life of this courageous and gracious and delightful man, Thomas Fairchild. It has been a whopping 35 years since I had the privilege of clerking for Tom Fairchild. Fresh out of law school, knowing practically nothing, I certainly did not know when I moved from Chicago to Milwaukee with my few items of clothing and a couple of boxes of personal effects that I was to spend a year under the tutelage of one of this nation's greatest judges. The year of my clerkship turned out to be the year that the appeal of the case known as the Chicago 7 trial was heard, and Judge Fairchild became the author of the principal opinion in the case. As this case was unfailingly cited in all the tributes to the judge after his death, I shall not omit to say something about it. As he said, it was big in terms of public interest. It symbolized the divide in America between the old guard and the young Turks, the law and order establishment, and America's youth rebelling against an unpopular war. We clerks were, of course, very excited to be where the action was. And it is fair to say that all three of us, we had an extra to help out in those days, were young Turks in our sympathies. Tom Fairchild approached this high-profile case, however, just as he approached every case, whether it was a pro se petition or a case testing the line that separates church and state or the reach of the Commerce Clause. He read the record, including all 22,000 pages of trial transcript. He read all 2,500 pages of briefs, and he read the cases cited in the days when cases meant pulling a book off the shelf and turning the pages to read it. In fewer than 3,000 words of spare and elegant prose, he captured the facts that laid the foundation for the court's conclusion that the Anti-Riot Act was not unconstitutional. Although Judge Fairchild was identified as among the liberals of the Seventh Circuit, this case exemplifies how his opinion about the war or his political inclinations did not impair his fealty to the record or the integrity of his intellectual pursuit. The Anti-Riot Act lies moribund as time and history have moved on. That which most endures of the case concerns the many, many claims of error arising from this very difficult trial and the particular personality of the judge who tried the case. It is a seminal case. It is a virtual guidebook set out in a tone respectful of the trial judge's task on how to conduct a fair trial, and without question, it influences every judge in this building, our circuit, and probably the nation every time a case is presented to a jury. People have said that Tom Fairchild was a great common law judge. By that, I mean the judge engaging in the imperfect reasoning described in Edward Levy's classic text, whereby the judge sifts the relevant facts from competing examples presented by prior cases to craft a rule of law that expresses the judge's understanding of the just result in the pending case. Judge Fairchild recognized that it is the common law's ability to adapt that permits the infusion of new ideas as society changes. From this willingness to accept change, he was in the vanguard of judges that embraced the use of the due process and equal protection clauses to break the logjam of society's resistance to equal rights for all persons. He was, in short, the finest of judges, and all of the family of law clerks and others who worked with him over the years would attest that he and Eleanor treated us like family. They hoped for the best for us, cheered our accomplishments, and mourned with us when our hearts broke. Nearing the end of his life, he set the standard, as he did in happier times, for grace and dignity. He never lost his love for doing law, Last spring, after he honored me with an invitation to give the Fairchild Lecture at the University of Wisconsin, he wrote me a note of thanks. In closing the note, he said, "I have been a member by phone of a panel deciding the unargued cases on three occasions since January 1st, and I will participate again on May 31st. They only let me consider three cases each time, so I don't contribute much, but I hope I am some help. These are not difficult cases, but you know, I can make waves in some." Anyway, I enjoy it. We have lost an exemplary man. He had a long and beautiful life. We are not entitled to ask for more, but we must not underestimate what we have lost in his passing.
Thank you, Judge Lefkoe. Judge Mason.
Friends and family of Judge Fairchild, I'm coming from a different avenue, if you will. I was not a law clerk of the judge. I was a deputy clerk in the front office of the Court of Appeals. And 33 years ago, when I started there, that's the way it was. Tom Strube, who was the clerk of the Court of Appeals, hired five of us to work out there. And for many years, we worked in the Court of Appeals with Judge Fairchild and the other judges, helping them in our own little ways, not sitting down and discussing with them the law, but trying to help them relax, and I think we were very good at that. And that started very quickly after we met Judge Fairchild, and even more so after he became chief judge and moved down to Chicago from Milwaukee, and was here for the next 6 years, I believe it was. During that time, we all got to know him quite well by our little get-togethers that we would have on Friday afternoons or Friday evenings, either in one of the chambers or down in Burgos, where we were invited by his law clerks to join him. And those were memorable times. Right away, we learned what a wonderful person he was. And I can't expound on his ability to write briefs or any of that sort of thing because I was never involved in that with him. But he was a great storyteller, as Judge Radji mentioned to us, and he would tell story after story and allow us to tell our stories, and we would try to outdo each other throughout the evening or the afternoon, whatever the case may be. He had a wonderful ability of bringing people together from the court, whether they were law clerks, deputy clerks, or court personnel. He would involve everybody in discussions. He would make you feel that he was interested in what you had to say, and he would listen to what we had to say and would very seldom criticize us for it. One of the things that I've talked to some of my former colleagues about was we would have these sessions at Burgos and we'd get in arguments over issues of the day or politics, that sort of thing. And when we came out with some wild, wild theory, he would just look at us, arch his one eyebrow and say, "Oh," and then rationally explain why we were ridiculous, if you will. One of the nicknames that we had for him was Thomas the Fair, because he was fair. And he was a delight to be with at all times. He would talk about current events. He would talk about politics. He would talk about his get-togethers with his Wisconsin lawyer friends from the Tri-County Bar Association. He would also talk about his family, his children, and his grandchildren with great delight. And he would ask us about our families. He loved a good story. He enjoyed hearing about someone's success, whether it was a former law clerk or one of the court personnel. In April of 1977, Bill O'Loughlin, who is here today, and I both passed the bar exam, much to the shock of everyone in the Court of Appeals. After we were admitted to the state bar and the federal bar, we applied to be admitted to the Seventh Circuit bar. Judge Rena Radji, Tom Struby, Collins Fitzpatrick, and Judge Fairchild got together, and they decided that it would be great if we did this admission in bank. So Bill and I decided that we would go for it. We went out to lunch that day before the hearing that we were going to have before the in-bank, and tried to relax the best that we could. We came back. Judge Radji made a wonderful, eloquent motion on our behalf, which I think was the only reason that they allowed us to be admitted to this episode. But Judge Bauer would have none of this. He wanted to ask us some questions. And he proceeded to ask us questions, and along the line of future interest. That was not our strong point. they admitted us anyway. Shortly after that, probably a couple of weeks after that, Jack and Maria Cooley had a party for Bill and I and several of the law clerks and the members of the clerk's office at his home, and Judge and Mrs. Fairchild were invited, and everybody had a great time. Nobody had such a good time as Judge Fairchild at any of these events that we went to. He loved life. He loved getting together with friends, and I think we were his friends, and it was a pleasure to have him. Then there were the weekly volleyball games that were, again, organized by Collins Fitzpatrick and Judge Rena Radji. Every Thursday night during the warm weather, we would play volleyball. The judge delighted. He played with us. He was 64 years old at the time. He played with us, and he enjoyed himself and our antics very much. After 1977, we all went our separate ways, we being the people from the clerk's office. But we kept in touch with Judge Fairchild. And thanks again to Collins Fitzpatrick. He would get us together, and we would go to dinner with Judge Fairchild at Berghoff's or any number of restaurants, listen to his stories. We'd tell our stories. He'd tease us. We'd tease him back. He took delight in that. And we look forward to these get-togethers. I had the wonderful opportunity after I left the Court of Appeals and I was working in the Federal Defender Office, and our office was here in this building, to have lunch with Judge Fairchild on Saturday afternoons. And we would go to lunch almost every Saturday for probably 3.5 years. Every Saturday is an exaggeration, but quite a few. And I was single in those days, so I didn't have a lot to do otherwise as far as commitment goes, so it was my pleasure to go with him. We would go to Burgos, and we would have the same meal every Saturday, and we got to the point where the waiter wouldn't even ask us what we wanted. It was goulash and a root beer, believe it or not, because we both had to go back to work. Judge Fairchild was so kind to all of us, and I feel he was extremely kind to me. He got me interested in things that I really never thought of before, namely classical music. He took me to see the Chicago Symphony a number of times, and I remember in particular seeing Isaac Stern perform. And he really helped me with that, and my wife has also increased my love for classical music, and we have a subscription to the Chicago Symphony and have had for a number of years, and we sit in the same area where Judge Fairchild and Mrs. Fairchild had their seats. In the fall of 1981, Judge and Mrs. Fairchild moved back to Madison, Wisconsin, where he had his chambers, but he would still travel down here on a number of occasions to sit with the court, usually by bus. And before he'd come down, he'd either call Collins and ask him to get a group of us together, and we would always get together because we thought so much of him. And we'd have dinner after he sat, either at Berghoff's or the Greek Town or some pizza place, and talk We'd tell the same stories over and over again. We laughed every time. And they got better with time, believe me. We added so many things to them. And then in 2001, I was picked to be a magistrate judge. And it was my pleasure to have Judge Fairchild, at the age of 88, get on the bus in Madison and come down here and speak at my swearing-in. For that, I will be forever grateful. It was wonderful of him to do that, and I think he knows how much I appreciated that. Tom Struby was the court clerk, and he had retired, and I can't remember exactly what year that was, but Tom has come back here a number of times, as we all are well aware, because he stayed with each one of us until we've had to throw him out. But Tom came back, and he wanted to go up and see Judge and Mrs. Fairchild in Ontonagon, up in Upper Michigan. So we said, okay, Bill O'Loughlin and I went with him. And we took off one afternoon around 3 o'clock on a Friday, I believe. We arrived up there around 11:30 at night, and Judge and Mrs. Fairchild were waiting up for us. They had a cold beer for us because they knew what pain Bill and I had gone through sitting in a car with Tom Struby for 8 hours. Anyway, the judge showed us around the area that he loved so much. He was using a walker at this time. And we were talking to him, and he said he really missed going down to the beach. And so Bill and Tom and I talked about it, and we said, what if we put you in a lawn chair and we'll carry you down to the beach? Well, he thought that was a good idea. And we did, too, until we started carrying the judge down there. It's hard. And, there were some sand dunes there, and I suppose it was 30 yards or so. But to us, it was like the Himalayas going up. And we teased the judge, and we said, you're like the Roman emperor. And he said, boys, whatever you do, don't drop this emperor. Well, we got him down to the beach, and we spent all afternoon there talking, reminiscing, solving all the world's problems. And then we came back, and by that time, he didn't care whether we dropped him or not. But we did have a wonderful time. And then on several other occasions, when he was up in Madison and unable to come back down here, Collins would recruit 7 of us, I think, a number of times, and we'd go up there. We'd go over and pick him up. And I remember the last time, Collins, when you and I went and picked him up and put him in your van, he really had lost control of his legs at this time, but he did not lose control of his sense of humor. Collins and I struggled for probably 40 minutes to get him into the van because we kept getting his legs stuck under the seat, and we'd all start laughing, including the judge. But he knew what was at the end, and what was at the end is we were taking him over to the beach at the Student Union of the University of Wisconsin so we could have beer and brats. And we did that a couple of times, and I think that he really loved it. He loved to see us, and we loved to see him, again, sharing stories. And then Jack Cooley and I would go up there to see the Fairchild lectures and go over to his house afterwards, which he and Mrs. Fairchild were gracious enough to ask us to do. And we would again talk and have a great time. You know, the one thing about it, the beer was a bonus, and we did have a lot of beer. And it was nice, but we would have all gone any place to see him, whether there was beer or not. It could have been Kool-Aid. We enjoyed his company so much. He was such an inspiration to all of us. He had so much energy and determination, and he kept pushing himself until the very end. He was always a gentleman, a gentle man, and Thomas the Fair. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Mason. And I want to point out to those of you who are with us today that one of the Fairchild traditions will be continued. We will hear a case en banc after this memorial, and that will be preceded by a mass swearing in. And since, unfortunately, Judge Bauer was unable to be present today, I just thought I would let the law clerks who are going to be sworn in know that we will be asking you in particular about the rule against perpetuities and and the rule in Shelley's case. So you will be prepared. I would also be remiss, since I've noticed that not to recognize one other person in the audience. Judge Fairchild's longtime secretary and assistant, Shirley Evans, is with us today. I know he thought very highly of her, and I suspect that she thought very highly of him, and we're very happy to see you with us today. Mr. Conway.
Correction, Shirley Newsom, only because she would be very unhappy with me if it hadn't been corrected.
Yeah, sure. Eye on my face, sorry.
I'm not sure about the advisability of having an Irishman follow an Irishman, but by being asked to go last, I will make every effort to keep it short. Lewis Quarles said the following in memorializing Judge Fairchild's beloved father, Chief Justice Edward T. Fairchild, 40 years ago. As a lawyer, judge, and citizen, he had a deep and unswerving integrity and a wide and deep feeling for his fellow man. He was warm-hearted, outgoing, and generous. His kindliness endeared him to all who knew him. How fitting these words are in describing his son. Obviously no coincidence. Despite the father's later efforts to ease his son into the idea of becoming a doctor, it was his father who introduced Judge Fairchild from an early age to politics and the law. And it was his father for whom he first clerked at the law school and who urged him to next take a position with a legendary Wisconsin trial lawyer, Daniel Grady. And ultimately his father who supported him, if not always encouraged him, as he began to pursue a public life as part of a very fledgling Democratic Party. Judge Fairchild was fond of relaying an early story of his career. It involved his own father, who was walking around the square in Madison, Wisconsin, around our Capitol, and he was confronted by a close friend of the family. Both he and the close friend being lifelong Republicans. As he approached him, he reached out, grabbed him by the shoulders, and said, "What has Dan Grady done to our Tom?" In fact, it was a remarkable group of young men, and at that point it was young men, Doyle, Nelson, Lucy, Proxmire, Reynolds, and Fairchild, who ultimately forged a new chapter in Wisconsin history. Combined with his experience in the Price administration as a U.S. attorney and in private firm practice, the judge brought, ascended to the Wisconsin Supreme Court with a remarkable blend of experience in politics, trial and corporate practice, and government service. It's been commented already that there was a single overarching style reflected in the judge's opinions. Perhaps it is his consistent effort to understand the facts and law from all perspectives without resort to formula, foreordained logic, prejudice, or preconception. In a genuine effort to reach what Carl Llewellyn called a right and fair solution, one that the parties could both recognize and accept. This was a quality that many have commented on over the years and has been commented on again today. You could look in so many of his decisions and see the effort to lay clearly forth the legal issue, the obscure patent claim, the perspective that an individual party brought to a particular case. My own favorite dates back to a decision that he wrote in 1963, when he was still on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Writing, as many's had during that period, about Henry Miller's Tropic of Cancer under Wisconsin's then obscenity law, and perhaps even treating in it what would now be considered quaint obscenities, the judge ultimately wrote, "Our reading of the book has engendered no enthusiasm. We do not endorse it. Our judgment will preserve its access to the marketplace where Wisconsin readers may buy it if they choose. In terms of the good that this particular book is likely to accomplish, we probably do no great thing in preserving it. Our function, however, is not to determine the quality of a book. Our duty is to respect and enforce in full measure the freedom of expression guaranteed by the state and federal constitutions. The judge actually loved being a common law judge, and it was reflected in those decisions, but as had been remarked, he went on to love as much his position in the federal judiciary, though he would wryly note on occasion that he made more law by being reversed than by deciding things. Not that Judge Fairchild was falsely modest. He knew his many talents. How could he not? But he never, to my knowledge, felt a need to put them out for show. When the judge would recall with remarkable clarity the name of an obscure street in a small town in Colorado he had visited once 60 years before, to the utter astonishment of someone who lived there now, or the factual details, complex legal issues, and procedural history presented by a relatively obscure series of appeals from a case 25 years before, to the wonders of those who clerked for him at the time. You never sensed it was to impress. On the contrary, you could see the delight the judge took in simply recalling that earlier time in his life, or the intellectual challenge of a knotty set of legal issues. With his natural eloquence, you could not help but be delighted too. The judge delighted in so much: a challenging legal problem, good conversation, a cold beer, funny stories, risque limericks, the plains and mountains of the West, the independence of his daughters, the shores of Lake Superior, his wife Eleanor, a political fight worth fighting, the sifting and winnowing of ideas, a deserved comeuppance, or the triumph of someone less fortunate. The judge genuinely delighted in life itself, with all its complications, challenges, heartbreaks, and joys. One never got the sense that any of it got him down or, frankly, surprised him. Life was life. You took it as it came and you made the best of it. In the last years of the judge's life, he quietly suffered the indignities that come with old age. Yet alert as ever, as has been noted, he continued to work away on Rule 34 cases until the final weeks of his life. I suspect there are some former staff attorneys who knew the joy of working with the judge in a Rule 34 case because he would pore over the record as any other case. The judge lived long and well and slowly died with grace, humanity, dignity, and courage in a way that I have never met and never expect to meet, as by all accounts did his father. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Connolly, and thanks to you all for participating in this celebration of a great life. This session is adjourned, and the court will take a brief recess before our en banc sitting.